I'm amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. My name's Steve W, and this week, Apple is being sued by the DOJ for improper use of monopolistic power, inflation in the UK hit a three-year low, and the US decided that it would leave interest rates unchanged. Obviously, so did the UK about 10 minutes later. But we don't have time to talk about any of those things. We probably should. They might be more important than things we do have. But there are more interesting things going on, and to discuss them, I'm joined by Steve D. How are you, Steve, and how has your week been?
Not too bad, Steve, to be honest. My back has loosened up a little bit, which is nice. It's just sort of stiff now and not painful, so I'm not slouching as much as I was last week. Although people were very kind and didn't comment on the fact that I pretty much laid down my chin on the desk for the whole episode. But yeah, it's not been too bad of a week for me, Steve. I'm still having my Fridays off, so I am off to this Friday as we record this. I actually think this is amazing, and I wish I could have 4 day weeks for the rest of my life. It'll be something that I'll be pushing for. Fridays off is incredible, especially when you get to Thursday and realize it's Thursday. That's pretty good. The times you get to Thursday and think, oh yeah, God, it's Friday, and you think, oh shit, no, it's Thursday. But now you think it is Friday essentially in terms of the working week. So yeah, it's been great. We're quite busy at work, but not busy enough that, you know, this is a problem having this time off. So it's kind of an easy week for me. But yeah, how's your week, Steve, been? How's your week in stocks been?
You answered my question I was going to ask you actually towards the end there. I was going to say, with all the 4 day week stuff, do you feel more productive? Do you feel like you've been more productive in your 4 days than you would otherwise have been? I mean, you're nodding. My instinct was going to be no, because there's nothing to do where you work, and therefore you haven't produced anything at all. But based on the fact that you were nodding, I was going to say maybe yes then.
And I definitely feel more productive, because I think I'm aware of the less time I've got. So, you know, the hours you might be talking about Helldivers with the couple of juniors who play PlayStation all the time, has sort of been reduced to a quick 5 minute chat, because you're sort of acutely aware that you've got like a pile full of quotes to get through, and you know, a load of emails to answer, and a load of orders to get out in time. So yeah, I think being acutely aware of the 4 days has made it made me work harder, I think. And yeah, I think that's a positive. I think, you know, in terms of productivity, I'd be interested to see it, because I think I've quoted quite a lot this week. I think I might have quoted the most out of a lot of us, done all my orders, answered every email, and I'm only in 4 days. So I think we'd be quite surprised if we switched to a 4 day week, just how, you know, how the people who, you know, want to work, I guess, apply themselves.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, I wondered about the 4 day working week. I actually found something similar when I first became a parent. All of a sudden there are these fixed things that you now have to work around, and working around them means that other stuff just has to get done in the windows that you have available for that left for doing that stuff, basically. And you can't look right or left or talk about things that aren't particularly work productive, and procrastination goes through the floor in a good way, to be honest. It feels much more productive, and then you kind of work expands again and it becomes a complete pain. But anyway, my week's been pretty good. We're in the first week that's actually felt like vacation week to me. So I spent all of last week doing what was basically in the office interviewing work, and it never really feels like term has ended when that happens. But term has ended, and it's ended now for a fortnight. And this week actually felt like I wasn't just catching up on things that were hung over from the term or things that needed to be done as part of the sort of general grind of work. This week I actually got a chance to get on with doing some stuff that I'm supposed to be doing when I'm not teaching everybody, so that was nice for a change. And actually there was more going on in the stock market than I thought there would be. I'm fairly convinced. I haven't worked out my returns because they're too difficult to work out. I bought and sold too much stuff this week, which isn't a huge amount, but enough to make it difficult for a distorting picture, and I'd have to do a money weighted thing, and I didn't find the time for that. So my instinct was that I must be I'm sticking with the thought that I must be behind every index, basically. I previously thought I must be down, but my portfolio is at a number that I haven't seen this high before ever, which means I can't possibly be down. I own stuff that has in general taken a bit of a whack this week, like Apple and like Weatherspoons, and we'll come back to Weatherspoons in a bit. I mentioned Apple before. But despite that, the number at the top of my screen is the biggest it's ever been. Other things have done fairly well. Primary Health Properties has moved higher, and I think that's gone quite a way towards offsetting some of the things that haven't gone that cleverly. But I'm not entirely sure exactly what's done so well for me, but I am up. I am almost certainly trailing every major market index that there is, and I'll probably just settle for that for the moment, especially with the FTSE having had a good week. I've almost certainly not beaten anything. How about you, Steve? Better week than, well, whatever I just said in stocks?
I think it's hard to tell. Again, I'm just looking at the numbers now. So mine says 2.63%, which I benchmark against the VWRP, the VRP, and that's 2.61, so 0.02 of a percentage above that. So I've got to be pretty happy with that. I think that's a pretty corking week. It would have been better for me, except Kering slipped 15% this week because of it issued a profit warning, which is very, very rare in the luxury sector. And we'll probably be able to explore that a little bit more when we look at the premium sportswear sector a bit later on today. And we'll be able to have a look at what's happening over there. But in general, I've had a pretty decent week. I'm just looking at the week's return now, and my top performing stock is the Zenda Group, which is up 8.4, and then I've got Enphase up 7, Carver up 5.7, Progeny up 5.25, Deca's up 4.75, Alpha Bet up 4.55. So, I mean, it's a way down before we're getting to the sort of number that VWRP is. So essentially half of my portfolio is beating VWRP as it is, so plenty to be happy about there, I think. So yeah, I'm doing fine. Like you, my portfolio was at all-time highs yesterday when we were putting this show together, but it isn't today because I think the European markets have just cooled a little bit following the rises yesterday. So but yeah, all looking pretty good to me. I am very happy chappy at the moment.
Yeah, that is pleasing stuff. I mean, you mentioned 2.6, a very, very rapid rough and ready back of the envelope thing. I get to 1.6 up for my portfolio. That's far too imprecise for me to really present that as a here's definitely the amount that I'm up this week. But it's something in the region of that, which is below VWRP, probably below the FTSE and the S&P as well. But there's been lots of interesting stuff going on in the market, quite aside from our portfolios. Steve, it feels like IPOs are just starting to tick up again. You mentioned Carver, but I guess what we're thinking of as the big one kind of came out earlier this week and appeared on Trading 212 reasonably swiftly, actually, from what I saw of it.
Yeah, was on when it went live to retail. They're normally pretty good at IPOs, to be fair to them. I don't think there's much to complain about there. I think most people just misunderstand how IPOs work and think that when the US markets open that they should have immediate access to the stock, and that's just not the case. Basically, the book builders get the first entry, and then you get the scraps. But yeah, Reddit IPO'd this week, Steve, and we'll take a quick look at it and see if there's anything of interest there. I describe it as essentially a posh chat board. It has a pretty large following, and it had a topsy-turvy kind of day yesterday, but it finished about $50, or that was about $9.5 billion in value. It's reported as jumping 48% off its list price. Coincidentally, that made OpenAI's Sam Altman about $200 million dollars richer on the valuation on the day. His stake now worth $613 million. So not a bad investment by Sam. So it's mostly centered around selling ads. This has helped the social media platform increase its revenue from about $229 million 4 years ago to $804 million at the end of last year. It's also posted losses of about $436 million from 2020 through 2023. It's never managed to profit from its broad reach. It's actually piled up cumulative losses of about $717 million. And they're even adjusted EBITDA negative of just over $62 million, which begs the question of why you would bother adjusting something. But yeah, plenty of cash, enough to last at least 5 years without any drastic uptick in spending. But it's, however, it's key to note this is already a 19-year-old business that it needs to really grow up, I would say. The company is hoping to bring in some more money by licensing access to its content in deals similar to the $60 million deal it's just done with Google. Basically, it's selling posting data and knowledge to help train artificial intelligence models. That fills me with fear. People on Reddit teaching AI. But that ambition, though, has faced pretty much an immediate challenge because the FTC in America has opened an inquiry into the arrangement. I think the FTC doesn't really like that user data is being sold like this without any kind of kickback to the user. So I think that's something to just keep your eyes on. But financials aside, and I mean, I don't say that lightly, there are definitely some trends here that you might like. I was reading the Aptopia study last night on the IPO, and a number of metrics has jumped out at me. So user growth is accelerating both through Q4 of last year and Q1 of this year. User engagement is deepening. Average users are spending about 15% more time on the site than this quarter last year. User growth has actually really ramped up, not just in the US, but worldwide too. Average spend per user per app is growing too. This means that despite adding lots of users, these aren't actually low-quality users that are degrading the metrics. The top 20 users are spending more time on the platform too. They're adding about 8% to their own platform use time year on year. And in terms of entertainment, Reddit does fall short of the majors, the things like TikTok, YouTube, and Roblox, if you count that. But the average time spent per user is better than X, i.e. Twitter, and just under what WhatsApp posted. So that was quite surprising to me. One of the things I've seen people pointing out, which was interesting, was they're saying that the CEO's comp was $193 million in 2023. First of all, I would just say just have another look at that, because the cash comp is only $1 million salary and bonus. And you'll notice that if you read the bottom of the footnote, refers you to the executive and director comp section, which says that it's essentially stock grants. So 5 years of stock grants over the $192 million, of which 50 have already converted. So that's actually only $38.4 million a year. So yeah, to miss something that basic when I saw a lot of the major newspapers reporting this is, well, just for headlines. But that does mean between the CEO and the COO, they're pocketing about $100 million stock-based compensation this year, and then about $42 million per year afterwards, and that's a lot of stock-based compensation. But this is a Silicon Valley company, Steve, and that's kind of what they do. In terms of ARPU, I think that's quite eye-catching. $3.42 per user. So there's your two flywheels there. Can they improve this number, and can they keep growing the number of people that are making this revenue? And if that happens, and it happens at a decent rate, then Reddit could potentially be a winner. So the $3.42 is made up of $5.51 in the US and $1.34 for the rest of the world. And anyone doing the quick maths here, you don't just add them together. It's an average. The main risk I spot is that it's wholly reliable on global ad spend, and thus it's going to be cyclical with the economy. And we saw quite a large pullback in spending just a couple of years ago, and it's only really just returning. So looking at everything here, I think it's a pretty interesting company. You can see why it's IPOing now, but I don't think I'll be buying it, Steve. I actually do use Reddit from time to time, and I do quite enjoy it, but I did recently delete my account because I don't really see the need in actually having one. So it's not a buy for me, but go on then, Steve, see if you will surprise me.
Nope, not really. It's not a buy for me either at the moment. I don't use Reddit, never have done. I think my general impression of it is partly quite heavily filtered through the fact that you only ever sort of see things when they're really in the news in some ways. So I think Reddit, my immediate association is Wall Street Bets, to be honest. And when you said it's a posh message board, I thought it was mostly full of memes and trash. And then you told me that you had an account there as well. And I sort of thought, well, why do I need to go there? I can just look on the 212 forum for all the memes that Steve wants to post everywhere. And I'm not quite sure what I would sort of gain from Reddit. I mean, when I think back a bit more, Wall Street Bets actually had in its dim and dark sort of history before it got into heaving zero-day expiry options everywhere. Actually some quite sensible stuff with some reasonable people posting thoughtful things and some decent information sharing and knowledge distribution through that community. So I can definitely see that there's scope for good here. It looks to me more like, though, the scope for good doesn't fit terribly well with what they kind of really need for an advertising platform, which is loads of people spending time on there, not particularly looking at it as a source of knowledge and information and insight necessarily, but just for entertainment purposes. Being dependent on global ad spend, I don't mind that. Reddit had always seemed to me kind of the best of the rest for quite some time in this sort of space when I think about the various social media platforms that there are. And I'm interested in sort of seeing it come on board as a public company. I can see why they're doing it now. I'm sort of a bit more surprised that they weren't doing it 2 or 3 years ago when it felt like everything was IPOing. In fairness to them, they've done pretty well on their first kind of day or so of trading, so they'll be reasonably pleased with how their IPO has gone. You mentioned Sam Altman, but everyone else as well has fared well after a strong kind of performance to get IPOs kind of back on the map, and this might coax out some more. I'm not sure who I'm thinking of as coming online, apart from maybe Sheehan, who is going to revitalise the London Stock Exchange group. With Reddit, I know about them a fair bit from having seen other people post there, but don't use it myself. It's been a long time not making any money like that, which kind of brings me back to my thought of why. What's the magic thing about 19 years rather than 16, 17 years of not making any money? I sort of feel like after that time, I would think, here is my opportunity to unload this thing, to be honest, and get paid for it. Not by the company, because the company can't pay me because it keeps losing money and all it can do is fire out options everywhere. And for those options to be much value, I need some way of selling them, or converting them and then selling them, which means that I need liquidity, most likely. So, yeah, I'm pleased it went well because I think that's encouraging for the IPO market. The fact that it went as well as it did means that I don't feel particularly inspired to buy it. It feels like it's in growth mode. 8 billion market cap isn't huge. That's after it kind of jumped a bit on the day. But there's nothing there that really kind of makes me think this is an obvious howling bargain.
Yeah, it wasn't even the best IPO this week, I don't think, Steve. So Amazon benefited this week from a pretty decent sized chunk in Astera Labs, which is another AI linked tech IPO. It supplies Intel and Nvidia with products, so that was obviously going to be a hot. It was basically data center connectivity chips, I think, and that had a pretty decent lump, a 72% jump in the first day of trading, and I believe that Amazon owns about a fifth of this company, or somewhere around that kind of amount, or has a warrant to buy around a fifth of this company. So expect more wonky Amazon results next time we get a hunk of earnings. But back to Reddit. Same as you, really, Steve. I think it's overpriced, and that's what IPOs stand for. It's probably overpriced. And I'll be interested to see this come down. At the moment, I don't think there's a figure that I would be interested in purchasing it. I want to see just a bit more sort of the finances and how they deal with being a public company and what the stock-based compensation is going to end up looking like. And then I'll maybe in a couple of quarters time, I'll start plotting some of that into the DCF and see if there's any value here. But at the moment, just looking at all the figures really, it sort of worries me that I don't think it's a primary venture for somewhere somebody's going to go and advertise. So in a period of time when advertising is getting withdrawn from everywhere, and people are just spending, you know, wherever they can get their hands on an advertising spot, I think Reddit's going to be one of the first places that people withdraw from, and that's quite worrying for me to own stock in a company like that.
Yeah, there's also the thing about AI, which I like use. I think I view this as kind of mostly noise, the stuff around AI. So they've got to deal with Google, right? Which tells you that that's not nothing, that there's something there at least worth kind of exploring in terms of what sort of data they have, and might that be a value for an LLM, and various other questions in that sort of ballpark. But I'm tempted to think sort of two moves away from the kind of picks and shovels and who benefits and who builds things that other people benefit from and who has things that kind of can benefit the people that build things that other people benefits from. Reddit doesn't seem massively likely to me in this regard. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's some stuff there that can be used to feed an LLM. But I think maybe this is the kind of point you were heading towards. But it feels to me like Reddit data would somehow make artificial intelligence less intelligent to me. And it would just generate more noise in a system rather than... you get more wrong results out by feeding it Reddit data, and people think, oh god, the machine's been looking at Reddit again, more than anything else. But maybe I'm wrong about that. AI isn't my strong suit, as investors or people who watch this show will absolutely know. What is my strong suit remains mysterious, but it isn't AI.
See, so Reddit's good for... The reason Reddit's so successful is that people's want to correct somebody's mistake is so high that when somebody posts a topic and says, I think this, you do get a wealth of pretty decent information from people, but there's no verification that the information they're giving you is correct. So it's pretty good for things like if you want somebody's opinion on like a crack in your wall, for example, if you've gone to some of the DIY subreddits and say, should I be worried about this crack? You're probably going to get some really, really decent, high-quality information from builders and what have you, or engineers who might just pop in and say, "Yeah, that's quite worrying. You should not do that." And the same way that I've commented before on things where I've seen somebody who's cut roof trusses before, and you're not supposed to cut roof trusses. You're really, really not supposed to cut roof trusses, and I've explained that to them. And that was good quality information. But then there were still a few people in there who were saying, no, you're wrong. And you're like, well, I'm not wrong because I've been doing this for 20 years. I know for certain I'm not wrong. That worries me in the same way. Like, how is that going to affect what the quality of information or output on these AI programs is. But I was reading a study, and Google said basically what they do is they weight the data they get. So if they get something from the New York Times and that gets weighted through, they say this is a highly trustworthy program or newspaper, they'll say something like that. I'll give that a 10 in terms of weighting. So, you know, trust that information more than you would trust the other one. Say they give the Reddit one a 2. And so that the AI will learn to trust the New York Times article more than the Reddit one, so it will use that information sort of more readily than the information on Reddit. So I think there's ways and means to sort of mitigate the risks from using, you know, solely Reddit data. I certainly won't be using solely Reddit data. And realistically, are they going to be able to use this going forward? It might not be the case that they're actually allowed to sell this data. And after that, we fall to this solely... sort of user economy come advertising sort of revenue base, which isn't as attractive to me.
No, I think if you were attracted by that kind of thing, there are more natural, more obvious ways to go about investing, both from a kind of mostly from a kind of perspective of companies that are actually going to make some money or appear to have any plans to make some money in the near future. I had a quick look at Reddit's balance sheet. Looks like what you would expect from this kind of company, because companies that have been losing money for 20 years don't typically have massive loads of debt. One reason is that it's quite hard to get any kind of debt, because who's going to lend you any money if your plan is to go and lose it for another couple of decades? So that looks encouraging, at least, but not massively surprising. To my mind, it would be more natural to look elsewhere if you thought that advertising was the kind of area that you wanted to be in. There are some things that trade at big PE ratios there. So Meta is currently back in fashion, very much so, and therefore trades at a high earnings multiple. At least it has an earnings multiple, though, in fairness to Meta, and it'll be interesting to see how Reddit shapes up. It might be one for us to keep an eye on. It'll be fun to see how this thing sort of progresses. I'm not sure it's not a case of waiting for to find this at a better price, I think, for me either. I'm not entirely sure the price I would be interested in this. I can't even work out a kind of cash flow calculator, because I can't work out when they're going to start making any money, so... the bit of discounting it back becomes far too difficult in this case. Be interested to see how it goes, though, as a sort of serial money losing and doesn't really care company. Steve?
Yeah, and I was just going to say, just to finish, and at this price, it's not an opportunity either. It doesn't feel like an opportunity for me to say, look, I'm not entirely sure when this company's going to make cash, but I'm certain they are. But it's trading at, like, you know, half a billion, mm-hmm. and I think when they do make cash, that should be quite easily covered. That's an opportunity. The opportunity with really just doesn't feel like it's here at the moment. And that might end up being like one of the stupidest things we ever say, Steve. You never know. This might just be absolutely, you know, the perfect place for advertisement. It might even be the next Meta. But right now, where I could see where adverts could go on Meta before they had advertising with Reddit, I can't see how they can ramp up the amount of advertising and, you know, put more of it in and without it causing like breaks in the quality of the content. So let's see. Let's see what they do. But at the moment for me, it's not a buy.
Yeah, I think I feel the same way, and I'm keen to detach that thought from the idea that the stock price is going to go down. I have no idea what this stock is going to do. It would not massively surprise me to see it double from here. It would not massively surprise me to see it triple from here, but I have no idea. No sense that I want to own this thing. If you tend to think, Steve, as you were saying last week, that what matters is total return, I think of it in, I think, the same way, but in a slightly different frame, which is what matters is what the underlying business does. And if you think that over the long term, the stock market is a weighing machine, those two things will converge, because you will get higher total returns from owning better, more productive businesses. If you think that, then you need to think something about Reddit that neither you nor I seem to be able to see at the moment, which is that somehow this thing is going to make a load of money at some point. And nothing in its history implies that it's going to. Perhaps there's a bit that we haven't seen. But that said, stock price can go anywhere from here. It's very new on the markets. It wouldn't surprise me to see it keep pushing higher for another week, month or year. But I don't particularly want to try and put my money behind the idea that it will, because I would be equally unsurprised to see it fall back through its IPO price. Anyway, earlier this week, Unilever made an interesting sort of announcement. Their shares went up 5% on Tuesday, but because this is a UK company, that's actually about 3% on the week as a result of it kind of sliding into that announcement and a bit of a turn down since. Here's the news then. Unilever, consumer brands company, is going to sell off some more stuff. And what it's going to sell off is its ice cream division, which is sort of interesting. At least I thought so anyway. It's planning on getting rid of these by the end of 2025, so there's about a year and 9 months or so until this is complete. So for context, Unilever is a company and a stock in transition. So they've restructured themselves into about 5 different operating divisions, and that happened around the start of the year, end of last year. Directly it happened, people immediately started looking at ice cream and saying, that one doesn't look like any of the other ones. Maybe they're going to try and sell that to somebody. And sure enough, what we've seen so far has been mostly out goes the stuff that you don't really want to focus on or invest in, and income. And the idea is to kind of double down on the stuff that you do. So away goes a bunch of kind of 90s hair products like Brill Cream and Timotei and VO5 and so on, leaving behind some of the things that the company feels better about. The reason I'm thinking ice cream is an interesting sort of spin here, and so far as I understand it, the plan is to IPO it and spin it out rather than selling it to someone. But I mean, as you would expect from Unilever, if they find a buyer who's willing to chuck them a load of money for it, then presumably private sell it. Don't mind doing that. But what I did think was interesting here is that if you think about them trying to double down on their strongest brands, I actually, the brands that come to mind for me for Unilever are ice cream brands in the first kind of instance here. Of the top 10 selling ice cream brands in the world, Unilever owns 5 of them, all of which are part of this kind of disposal unit, which leads to the obvious question then, Steve. Can you think of the 5 brands in the top 10 in the world by sales that Unilever owns in ice cream?
The only two I can think of was obviously Ben & Jerry's, which has been a thorn in sort of Unilever's side for quite a while. Yep. Because it's quite independent, isn't it? So I guess Walls, I think it owns. And I would go with, I'm going to say Magnum, but I think that's a Walls thing anyway, isn't it?
You can have Magnum. Magnum is apparently counted separately, even though I think of it as also a kind of offshoot from Walls. So Magnum is correct.
I wouldn't be able to get any more, I don't think.
I'm not surprised. The other two are more American-sided than these. They are Breyers and they are Halo Top, which is sort of like Ben & Jerry's but with fewer calories, except for the Ben & Jerry's that also has fewer calories. They're both all right, by the way. I've done extensive research into both of these things and they're fine. Not as good as Ben & Jerry's, but generally not as expensive either. So out goes this bunch of brands that are actually sort of fairly powerful things. By the way, I view it as a scandal that none of the top selling brands include Cornessos and V&S's, both of which are Walls products. But hey, the idea that Magnum is outselling either of those two things is frankly a scandal for me as a 90s child who thinks that roughly the height of food engineering was when they got those wavy bits into V&S's. But I digress. Why, then, is the question for spinning out ice cream division? Because, look, if we think these are actually... If you like branded products, Ben & Jerry's is the brand that everyone seems to think actually genuinely sort of means something to some people. It's a good product. It's well known. It's pretty well liked. It has been a nuisance to them, but they've decided to try and off some of their Israel Ben & Jerry's operations into a kind of, by now licensing that thing, which to me seems like a significantly more intelligent move than what they had before. But off these things all go. The reason being, ice cream as a category compared to some of their other things is both capital intensive and low returning. For the pretty obvious reason that you have to freeze it quite a lot. You have to freeze it in production, you have to freeze it in storage, and you have to freeze it in transport. And all of that costs energy and costs money in ways that storing things like bleach, as in consumer product bleach, and stock cubes and whatnot, don't. So the thought is that they will improve returns and they will improve margins like this. In doing so, speaking of margins, they will dispose of about 7,500 jobs. Which is about 5% of their workforce. So you'd expect costs to come down and potentially margins to widen as a result by kicking out all of their kind of significantly more capital-intensive, more expensive-to-produce things. And this is a strategy, by the way, that we've kind of seen elsewhere. So I initially liked the Unilever restructuring and got the idea of let's get rid of some Brill Cream and Timotei stuff that we're still producing that realistically has probably had its day. I was amazed, by the way, that I think I expressed on JKR's show that I was amazed that they managed to sell those brands to anybody. I thought Brill Cream is just a thing that you sort of phase out and stop putting Brill Cream labels on things. I was amazed anyone gave them any money for that. That seems like a hell of a good sale, and I've been critical of Unilever's acquisitions in the past. But selling somebody Brill Cream as a brand and saying, here you are, you can now have the rights to produce Brill Cream is, that's good work. Kellogg's we've seen spin things, GSK we've seen spin things, out came Haleon, Johnson & Johnson we've seen spin things, out came Kenvue. It's generally a big theme of let's dispose of some of our lower performing assets and focus on our higher performing ones, mostly due to a higher interest rate environment. There's what it makes sense to do when you can turn this kind of return using your cash, and there's what it makes sense to do when you can earn that kind of return using your cash, and less profitable things or less growth-oriented things are just falling by the wayside left, right, and centre at the moment. And arguably, there might be some value there. I view one of those as a big miss on my part, but we'll come back to that in a little bit. The risk, I think, then isn't with streamlining their portfolio. They've got a new CEO, Heinz Schumacher, who I'm going to assume he knows what he's doing in spinning the ice cream division, and that the value of the brands, which I think there is genuine value in those brands, is offset by the capital intensity of the business. So I'm going to assume that move is okay. And if I'm on board with that move, I'm fine with the idea of selling off this part of that business. They're expecting to save around $684 million over the next few years, which is helpful. But the big question I kind of have is what a company like Unilever is going to do with the cash it generates by spinning these things. So they're guiding and forecasting and talking about 5% top line growth. And if the idea by that is they're going to invest into their remaining products, I'm not sure that there's the power here to grow these things at 5% top line. These are things like Knorr stock cubes, Hellmann's mayonnaise, Domestos bleach. I'm not that convinced that these are things that require that can grow with massive force here. I don't rate the power of its brands elsewhere the way I rate the power of its ice cream brands. So to me, that's where the kind of risky bit, the bit that worries me, kind of comes in a bit. So I'm okay with the idea that they're spinning these the ice cream division out. It makes sense to me of a sort. I'm not sure that trying to reinvest behind the brands they have left is necessarily a particularly attractive growth strategy. Steve, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it, really? Because when you read this presentation, they reported 7% underlying sales growth. but 60.1 billion in revenue in full year 2022 and 59.6 billion in full year 2023. So yes, there's been some assets and disposals in there, but essentially we add that to a little bit of currency. Sorry, acquisition and disposal, but 5.7% slip in currency has meant that essentially we're down in terms of in terms of revenue by, you know, quite a fair chunk. Interesting little presentation this though, Steve. I mean, I was quite shocked to see that, even though it's a massive area, so it doesn't take much thinking, but I wouldn't have guessed that Asia Pacific and Africa was Unilever's biggest area by almost double. 26 billion of its turnover from Asia Pacific and Africa. The next biggest is North America at 13, Europe at 12 billion, and Latin America at 8 billion. And Latin America is actually growing pretty decent, 14.9% underlying sales growth there. So that's quite impressive as a little sort of growth area of growth that they've got going on here, especially when it's not a million miles away from, you know, your likes of Europe and North America, which are growing at 4 and 5.8%, and Asia Pacific, which they reckon is growing at 6.5%. So that, I mean, that's quite interesting to me, but there's a little bit of margin expansion going on. This is evidently evidently working. They're evidently getting rid of the sort of lower margin stuff for decent cash generation, 7.1 billion in free cash flow this year, and return on invested capital of about 16.2%, which is not too bad. 2.1% net debt to underlying EBITDA, but still 23.7 billion in net debt. I think that's the next area that they need to focus on, is getting that pile of debt down. I think they've for a company called Unilever, they've overlevered for the last couple of years, and they really need to sort that out. And when they do that, they're going to look like a much sort of tidier, interesting looking company to me. But there's no real signs of that being a focus at the moment. So yeah, with you, I'm quite sort of shocked that they managed to get rid of some of those products, but I suppose Brylcreem is a decent brand. You don't have to sell the products it currently manufactures. You could add that brand to some other product and sell it, and that might be a reason why you'd want to buy that. But yeah, I'm not massively into that. The only other thing I was looking at was this ice cream sale, which is interesting. I guess you've explained that quite well, really, why that's going. But even in their presentation, they referred to it as disappointing performance reflecting poor execution and consumer downtrading. I guess that kind of sells it, doesn't it? It's basically just said, yeah, we're not very good at ice cream. We've got this massive portfolio of ice cream, but we're rubbish at it. So, yeah, interesting to see that they've done that. I don't know if I'd be tempted to spin that out, though, Steve, and try and IPO it. It's about 7.9 billion in ice cream, all in all. That might make an interesting little company for them to spin out. And the only issue I can see, really, is that it's not really growing. And I sort of have that thing in my head where I think if you spin this out, I wonder if Nestle just buy it, or somebody like Mars, or somebody who has a sort of chocolatey, sort of big chocolate portfolio would probably want to take this over. But yeah, interesting to me, Steve. It's not a company I'm interested in buying. For me, there's just not I can't spot this growth flywheel that I really want to sort of like hang my hat on and say this is the one metric that I want to track here. Latin America is growing okay, but whether that continues is I'm not entirely sure, but I don't know, Steve, what's your take?
I agree with you that spinning this is the thing to do. I think the people who buy this, if someone does buy it, would be someone who's already got a kind of well frozen production line that they can plug this into. That seems to me to be the big thing that is currently holding Unilever back. It doesn't want to own a load of freezer assets and so on, and have to use those to produce ice creams, especially if it turns out those brands are not strong enough to prevent downtrading from consumers, which is a bit of a surprise to me. I thought they might have been reasonably powerful, but there is a difference, I guess, between your ice cream consumption and your use of bleach. I mean, there should be a difference between your ice cream consumption and your use of bleach, but especially in a kind of shopping terms, one of them you have to buy and the other one you don't. I think cleaning products you kind of need, ice cream, well, you have to eat something but you don't have to eat that, and so there's, I guess, maybe more scope for down trading in that category. I think they will spin this out, because I don't think they'll get a kind of good enough offer to just sell it to somebody. They talked about in the presentation trying to give it some more visibility for that part of their business. But it's not clear to me that you really want more visibility if you think you have poor execution, weak results, and a lack of growth going on. I mean, whenever you're trying to spin something, and I compare this maybe to the what I said about the UK government trying to sell NatWest shares earlier in the year, there's always a bit of a dilemma, right? On the one hand, you have to explain why you're getting rid of it. And that's got to be a bad thing. You can't be saying, look, this is amazing. It's the best thing we own. Now we're going to sell it because we think someone's going to pay for it, or even that. But equally, you can't tell people it's a complete dog. Otherwise, there's a real question of why the hell should they go and buy it? I mean, if it's such a great business, why aren't you keeping it? Is the obvious question here. So there's always a delicate balancing act. It feels like Unilever shouldn't. It feels to me like strategic buyer is the kind of avenue they might end up going down. But towards the end of 2025, I wonder whether this might be one to keep an eye on here. After the Kellogg, the formerly known as Kellogg, spun its cereal division a couple of, well, a few months back now, possibly a year or so even, I had a look at that and I saw the price of the spun out assets, the cereals business, going through the floor. It was about half what it is now. And I looked at it and it had about a 7% dividend yield because I think the market hadn't properly caught up to where it was. And cereals is not a growth business by any means. It's the kind of business, though, that can be all right if you can get it cheap enough. And I think it was cheap enough back then and I didn't do anything about it, which I'm annoyed at myself for. All you had to do was just see that this thing's falling because it's been spun out, and it's been spun out because they think it's an anchor for growth. Sure. But if you're going to buy the thing at between 6 and 8 times earnings, it arguably doesn't need to grow very much at all. So I feel like I missed a trick there, that I'm going to keep a closer eye on this spin-off. I don't anticipate this going as badly. I think the market will, if anything, overweight the brands that Unilever is sending out with its ice creams, despite it not having a particularly interesting record in the last couple of years of holding market share. It seems to be losing it a bit. And that's roughly where we're up to on that, I think. Let's talk about Nike.
So Nike reported Thursday night, and they reported revenue was up 0% year on year to $12.4 billion, which is actually $130 million beat because they'd guided for negative revenue last quarter, so that's somewhat of a positive. Non-GAAP EPS was 98 cents, which was a 23 cent beat, and interestingly, pulled from the report, that gross margin increased by 150 basis points to 44.8%. And they said that this was driven by strategic pricing actions and lower ocean freight and logistics costs, which was offset by higher product input costs and restructuring charges. But still, up is up. Inventory was down 13% year on year to $7.7 billion. That's good to see. Direct sales was up 0% year on year to $5.4 billion. And there was about $300 million in restructuring charges, which is basically what happens to any company when the growth starts to slow. They start to waste money and putting themselves from 3 departments into 4 or 6 departments into 2. And somehow that makes growth reappear. In Europe, the Middle East and Africa, revenue actually fell by 3% to $3.14 billion, which was actually worse than the $3.17 billion that analysts had expected, according to Street Account. It became the latest fashion brand to express worry about the Chinese market, where sales only grew 5% to $2.08 billion, which was below the $2.09 billion that analysts had expected. Sales in Asia Pacific and Latin America rose 3% to $1.65 billion, which was below the $1.69 billion analysts had expected, according to Street Account. And Nike shares rose about 5% after this report came out. But then when the guidance dropped, or when they got to the guidance in the call, it dropped by as much as 7%. Now, I haven't looked at it yet, Steve. It might be worth you pulling it up and seeing where it is at the moment, because the market has opened for us. But excluding restructuring charges, the company reiterated its sales outlook for fiscal 2024. It said it expects revenue to grow by a massive 1% in line with expectations, which LSEG said was 1.1%, so that's close enough, I guess. For the current quarter, it expects revenue to be up slightly compared to the estimates of about 2%, according to LSEG. And some strange things that I spotted, Steve, buried in the presentation, was that they've actually won the contract to be the new kit supplier for the German national team from Adidas, a German company. So 77 years that Adidas has held this deal, and I find it sort of strange. But this deal kicks in 2027, so that's something to look out to look out for. See, this is one that was on your radar of things to buy. Is it closer to a buy for you now?
Yeah, it is. I've just had a little look. It's down 8.5%. So that's quite the drop out of the gate this morning. I got a nice push notification from Trading 212 telling me it was down 6%, which it is now slightly out of date. I'm just trying to look. Nike, the company, I'm just figuring this out. Yeah, so they've designed a New England kit as well, which is, I don't know if you've seen this, it was all over Twitter last night, but they've taken the St. George's flag and turned it into a nice rainbow flag. And that would be good. Maybe they could get hold of the German flag and do something similar, because that's got some nice colours on it too that they could go messing about with. I saw that they were guiding for weakness in China in terms of sales going forward. And that immediately made me think, and I said to you, okay, weakness in China equals Burberry will be down tomorrow. And out of the gate, I was completely wrong about that. I am now, however, right. Having seen that, like, this is how long it takes the UK, by the way, to catch up to what's going on in the US markets. Having seen Nike go, I mean, well, start off up 5% in post and then down 5% in post. The Burberry share price said, don't know what to make of that. And then down again 8%. It said, oh, all right, maybe I better start going down in that case. But I thought Nike is an interesting sort of company, an interesting position. I think right now there are other more interesting companies in more interesting positions. In general, I sort of think of this as something that tends to be fairly cyclical. And I was looking to use this as a barometer for when cyclical stuff is going to start recovering. And as a result of this, my kind of instinct is not that soon. Whether it's the thing I want to use as whether I want to invest in and buy shares in a down part of a cycle, another question. Maybe. It feels like it's a bit closer, but I'm probably not quite there yet with other opportunities that I can see at the moment. Did you get that revenue growth number quite right? You said up 0%. I thought it was down 0%.
My bad, Steve. My bad. I think it was actually up. When I looked at it, the number was up, but it was up only slightly? Up by like a few dollars.
Sure. Okay. So it was up 0%.
I was interested. Fine. So I was looking at your rainbow flag comment last night, and I noticed that renowned thinker and ex-Tottenham midfielder Jamie O'Hara had weighed into the debate, saying that when he wore the England shirt, which I don't actually remember him wearing an England shirt, so it must have been in the under-21s, but when he was wearing an England shirt, he used to feel a lot of pride wearing the flag with the St. James's red cross on it, and it was pointed out to him using a picture of him playing in his England shirt that he played in an England shirt that had lots of coloured crosses on the top. So he was evidently misremembering, which is a shame for somebody like Jamie O'Hara, a renowned critical thinker. But yes, looking at Nike's share performance today, Steve, versus Adidas. Adidas is actually up 0.14%, which, you know, it's better than its performance on the week. It's down about 1.52% on the week, which has probably got something to do with losing that Germany contract. And just had a quick look at Puma as well. That's down 2.14% on the day, down 6.68% on the week. So, yeah, a lot of fear in the kind of market around this kind of premium goods. So if we link that to what Kering said at the this week, basically, that they said that their Asia Pacific sales are going to drop by potentially around 20%. Coming into this quarter, you can sort of see that the Chinese market weakness is you know, providing overall weakness for companies in this sort of like luxury and premium sector. And Nike is another company reporting, well, not just Nike, but Lululemon, that we'll get to later, also reporting weakness coming from China, which has been the sort of growth engine for a lot of these companies now. Adds to your sort of bearish, at least in the short-term nature, take on China here. Steve, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Not at the moment. I mean, the reason I get interested in these is because I sort of start thinking when share price is going down, I start wondering about the possibility of overcorrection. I'm not seeing that in the case of Nike, but I sort of think when you have a company, Burberry's a better example, that is quite closely associated with China, and people think, well, China is where that growth is going to come from. And for a long time, it was the UK's way of exposing itself to the Chinese middle class, or the growing Chinese middle class, was Burberry. And then that starts going wrong, things can start to fall away quite quickly. And then I sort of start wondering, well, look, even if I just discount the China bit entirely, how bad value does this look? So I don't think China sales are going to zero, but what would happen if they did? Then you can work your way backwards from there. I don't think in Nike it's likely to make that look like a bargain for me. Nike is currently still, as far as I can see, trading at a price that reflects the thought that they do things like manage their celebrity endorsements and tie-ups and partnerships better than most do. Actually, they've historically had a pretty good way of thinking about things like Air Jordans, and these things have enduring popularity, and they will come back again, I think, in time, in ways that we saw last year. I think Adidas struggling a bit with some of theirs. Under Armour has been an almost total disaster, I think, for shareholders, as far as I can see, even though I really quite like their product. Do you think, I suppose the next obvious kind of question when I think of footwear in particular, would it be the best thing for Nike if they were just acquired by Deckers?
It would be, if they want some success, that would be the way to go, Steve, wouldn't it? Just to get yourself acquired by Deckers and let them show you how to grow a new brand. Just looking at this England football shirt, Steve, and if you did something you want to be offended about, I wouldn't worry about the flag on the back. It's £125. Now, I haven't bought an England shirt in a very long time, but I seem to remember them being about 40. Am I that old?
No, I think that's where you're from. £125 gets you a striker where you are, doesn't it?
Well, don't know, because I think Hull have a pretty decent team at the moment, don't they? I think they've got a Turkish billionaire owner, so I think they're spending quite a lot of money. But I'm actually a Blackburn fan, Stephen. £125 would get us a half decent striker, I think. I'd be looking for that.
Okay. So you're thinking back to the glory days of Chris Samba playing at either end of the pitch under Sam Allardyce and that kind of thing. Got it. That roughly concludes my thoughts on Nike, I think, which I'm not actually sure I offered any whatsoever, but maybe this is a more entertaining video than some of the others. But I'm interested in what Nike shows me about other companies, basically. I think their reporting kind of gives me a feel for how the kind of macroeconomic cyclical things are developing and shaking out, and whether there's a kind of light at the end of the tunnel. And the honest answer is, it seems to me like there probably isn't just yet. But that's sort of okay. I feel like when macroeconomic things shift around and different things start falling into value territory and go out of favour and so on, well, then I have to try and figure out where they all are. At least if they stay still for a bit, that's reasonably straightforward. Like when interest rates were starting to rise, it seemed to me fairly obvious that wasn't being reflected in banks. I think it probably is now when you look at Lloyd's, that's made it past the grand total of 50p. But so I'm interested in Nike for what it shows me about this area more generally, rather than intrinsic features about it, I think. Steve, you similar?
Yeah, same sort of idea, really. I mean, I am quite interested in buying Nike at the right kind of price, but I need to see where this growth's going to come from now. And if you're telling me I've got to wait for China to do some kind of economic recovery or to really, you know, deliver some pretty heavy stimulus to people, then that worries me a little bit. That's not the kind of growth that's a nice to have for me, rather than something I really want to rely on. So, yeah, not interested in buying Nike here, but would be interested if people want to comment in the comment section and let us know what we're missing here, and other than, you know, it being a trusted brand or what have you. This is one of those where people say it isn't going anywhere. Yeah, we can see that in the financials.
Yep, and at that price tag, it probably does need to figure out a way of going somewhere. However, a place where you can see lots of England shirts, at least if you go at the right time of the year, is the pub. And JD Weatherspoon's reported its interim trading update today, which means that it is one of those updates that does have some numbers. In fact, it has quite a lot of numbers, almost confusingly many numbers. Here's one to start you off, though. Stock is down 8.5%, which puts it back slightly below where it was at the start of the year. Make of this what you will. So let's start with some easy stuff then. Headline numbers. Revenue came in, this is for half a year, by the way, at $991 million, which was up 8.2% compared to the same period in the previous year. Like-for-like sales were actually up 9.9%. So if you think of those as roughly same-store sales, but same pub sales, basically up 10%. The reason that that's higher than the number being reported for revenue growth is they sold some of their pubs. So they got rid of some of the ones that they don't like the look of, in a bit like Unilever dumping its ice cream brands, to be honest. They've got rid of things that are either lease held or not particularly profitable. And as a result, their revenue growth is 8.2 rather than 9.9. Operating income is $67 million, which is 81% higher than the previous year. So far, so good. So why the down 8.5% thing? Earnings per share came in at 14.7p. A year ago, they were 29p. So that's roughly cut in half despite revenue going up and operating profit almost doubling. So the very obvious question then is, what in the hell is going on here? It could be that they've roughly quadrupled their share count, which they haven't, so we can lose that idea. It could be the idea that they've got some very special charges that we ought to worry about, and that the future looks much worse than it will in the future. I'm not sure that's quite true. What they do is offer you two different versions of pretty much all their accounts. So sometimes we see profits and adjusted profits, or underlying profits and reported profits, or sometimes we see things like adjusted EBITDA, which Steve, you mentioned recently, and that's an adjusted metric being adjusted again. But what they offer is two sets of accounts. One is what they consider to be, roughly speaking, their core operations, which is what you think it is. It mostly comes from food, beer, and fruit machines in their case. But the other is what they consider a bunch of separately disclosed items. So what they consider to be either not important or not recurring or anything like that. And over the last couple of years or so, there's been a lot of noise in both directions in their separately disclosed items. So what we might call the kind of non-adjusted version. So you can read down three columns. And as I was showing you earlier, Steve, it looks like they've kind of accidentally adjusted their earnings per share number in the separately disclosed items, because the per share profit is positive while the actual profit isn't. So I think what happens is you have a loss of about 5p. But here's what this list of adjusted things is for the moment. They've been selling pubs, and they've been selling them below the value they were carrying them at, so they recognise a loss on that. That goes through the income statement. It weighs on the bottom line. They've also had the value of some interest rate swaps they have downgraded, so they're carrying them at less than they were carrying them at before, and that also goes through as a charge on the income statement. And they've also taken some impairment charges on some of their properties where they don't think they're going to generate enough cash to justify the value at which they're currently holding them. So a whole bunch of accountancy things. There were some positive ones as well, by the way, but I focused on the three that were all negative, and that's what's dragging reported net income down and what's causing earnings per share to fall. So what do things look like if you strip them out? Well, a lot better is the sort of short answer. You get to about 19.6p in profits, but importantly, a year ago you got to 1.1 if you just looked at kind of core underlying operations. So that's about 18 times higher than it was before, which is making a bit more sense given that the revenue numbers were up and the operating income numbers were up. Another thing weighing on that, by the way, is that there are also some huge numbers weighing on the last year's reported profit from separately disclosed items, or as it were, non-adjusted things. They were the sale of a bunch of interest rate swaps, which protected Spoons against some rising interest rates, and they got quite a lot of money by selling them, which is the reason that those things were very high. So their actual underlying, as it were, earnings per share were about 1.1p. To an extent you can make what you will of that, but it doesn't look like a recurring thing, and most of their charges this year look like non-cash charges to me. They definitely happened, they're not good things, but they're probably not an indication that people are getting fed up of going to the pub for the time being. What is a cash charge, and worried me a bit more, or caught my attention a lot more, was a $6.1 million outflow for free cash flow. Last year, that came in at $166 million, which is what happens if you sell like 100-something million's worth of swaps. That fell all the way to minus 6.1 million. The company put that down to payments to suppliers, basically, and when it's been making them. So it's taken about 40 million's worth of outstanding payments to suppliers off its balance sheet and paid them off in cash, effectively. So not a big problem. They were getting paid at some point or another. But what has replaced that on the balance sheet is about 40 million's worth of debt. So the company took debt on to do that. That's, as far as I can see, the biggest red flag here. I doubt very much that's the reason the market is discounting shares today. But I'm not a massive fan of seeing this company going leverage heavy again. What I note from reading the report is that all of their outstanding debt at the moment is covered by, or is hedged using swaps until at least this time next year, effectively, or at least the end of that trading period next year, sorry. And the average rate at which those swaps would kick in is about 4.7% if you try and weight them. So there's sort of 200 million and 400 million at different rates on debt of about 600 or so. So they should have some decent visibility of what their interest is going to look like in a worst case scenario for the next year or so, at which point they'll probably clear them out and find a way of doing it again. So stock falling. I was reading Hargreaves Lansdown's analysis of this, and they said market worrying about growth with the number of pubs coming down. I'm not sure I think that's right. I think about 10% underlying growth is fine here. And they are in a situation where they've increased prices a couple of times over the last year, and with the way their margins work and the way their business is structured, any slight price increase, which still keeps them well below the level of their competitors, actually has the potential to swing their earnings per share quite a bit at the underlying level, which is why you saw things going from sort of 1p to about 19p or so. Last point, no dividend here, but they did buy back about 3.5% of their shares in the last 6 months, which kind of caught my eye. They said after taxes and so on, that came in at about 7.79p, but if they keep doing that at that rate, that will be quite a significant lump that they'll start taking out of it. They have a large employee compensation package, but I believe, and I need to double triple check this, they do this by buying in their shares and distributing them to employees, not by printing new ones, mostly. So they have a kind of ordinary pub workers get shares in the business, but I'm not convinced that comes from printing. I think that comes from buying them back in and giving them away again, so they get benefits in stock rather than cash, but it doesn't actually save them any cash. It's a different way of going about that, so I wouldn't view that as kind of the same as ordinary stock-based comp. What it does mean is it goes through their cash flow statement in a way stock-based comp doesn't. So stock-based comp gets added back when we look at free cash flow, because cash doesn't leave the business. In this case, it does. It gets used to buy shares that are sent out to employees, and therefore is reflected in that negative free cash flow number that I saw there. Slightly more complicated than meets the eye. There's lots to try and work your way through here. It doesn't help that some of the numbers are written incorrectly in the report. But Steve, what are you looking at there?
So I'm just currently reading the Tim Martin manifesto at the beginning of the presentation, where he's basically sort of done a page about the business, and then it's like three pages on all of the things he thinks currently about the Wild. There's also a whole page based on how pubs contribute to the economy, with a massive table of the amount of tax that they pay, and he has studiously listed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 different taxes and or grants. Then there's a whinge in here about the composition of boards at UK quoted companies. And that's kind of my problem with this company, is that the chairman is an absolute nutcase who spends the vast majority of his time whinging about other things and going on TV rather than focusing on the quality of his company and how it performs. So, yeah, that's what I'm looking at. Actually, these results are not that bad. And you're going through them thinking, and yes, I can spot there are some errors in the way things are written. The earnings are listed as being negative, and then you can see quite clearly underneath it that EPS is reported as being positive. Now, I don't understand how that works. That's just strange. But there's some sections in here, like the Soil Association have ranked us as the greatest restaurant out of this list of 20, Pizza Hut being the worst. The Soil Association. I don't know what to make of it, Steve. I feel like going through this presentation for me would annoy me, you know, because I just want to learn about what the business is doing and how it's trying to improve and what the actual figures are. And the vast majority of this just sounds like an angry man in the pub. Do you know, like the angry man in the pub who has to tell you you're wrong about something? And that's generally how I feel about reading a Weatherspoon's presentation. But yeah, I don't really have a lot on this one, Steve. As you know, I'm not a massive fan of Tim Martin or Weatherspoon's. I don't think I've set foot in a Weatherspoon's in, it must be 15 years. So not a massive draw for me at all, to be honest. Do you have anything else, or would you want me to shuffle on?
That's quite impressive. I hadn't clocked the Soil Association's news, I'll be perfectly honest from that. But I think I'm trying to work out what I should make of that. Probably nothing is the answer, but I immediately have a favourable impression of anywhere that scores Pizza Hut down the bottom of its list of places that they're assessing and evaluating and so on. I don't rate Pizza Hut particularly highly myself. I think that's pretty much it. I thought the shares might have been getting a little bit ahead of themselves going into this particular earnings report. I wonder whether they're getting a bit behind themselves at the moment. But the biggest risk I have with Spoons at the moment, or the biggest risk factor I see, is the almost inevitable change of government that I think is coming. The biggest cost that this company, as with pubs in general, this is not a Spoons unique thing by any means, is the potential for higher wages, effectively, and bigger wage demands, and that will be difficult on margins. It will arguably be worse for Spoons. I'm not sure about that, but I don't like the look of this across the sector at all. Obviously, they pay VAT on food where other places don't, if you don't serve it as a hot meal. So, I mean, they're handicapped enough in that regard. The thing that really concerns me looking forward is exactly what's going to happen in terms of wage costs for this business. That would be my number one kind of thing I'd be worried about. But I can see why, if I were in charge of this, I would probably look elsewhere. Let's talk about Lululemon instead, Steve.
Lululemon topped expectations, Steve. It reported earnings per share of $5.29 versus $5 expected. Revenue was $3.21 billion versus $3.19 billion expected. So decent beats on both. Steve, I'll ask you to have a look again to see how Lululemon's doing today because I've forgotten to open it up. So it reported net income for the three-month period that ended Jan 28th. That was $669.5 million. That's about $5.29 per share compared with $119.8 million or 94 cents per share a year earlier. So quite healthy growth there, just a few 100%. Sales rose up about 16% from $2.77 billion a year earlier to, again, $3.21 billion. Like Nike, Lululemon's been sort of grappling with uncertain demand, and there's been a slight slowdown in discretionary spending that's hit the apparel space quite hard. They said in the call that consumers they feel that consumers are having a choice between sort of discretionary clothes spending and having experiences, and at the moment they seem to be sort of just edging toward experiences. In terms of international sales, they grew 54% on a reported basis. Sales in China grew 78%, and it was 36% in the rest of Lululemon's market. So healthy growth internationally. Comparable sales was about 12% growth during the quarter and was just shy of the sort of 12.3% uptick that analysts had expected. But it was a total miss on guidance. For the current quarter, Lululemon expected net revenue to be about $2.18 billion to $2.2 billion, representing growth of about 9 to 10%. Analysts wanted $2.25 billion, growth of 12.5%. They said that they thought diluted earnings would be between $2.35 and $2.40, which was quite a bit below the $2.55 that analysts had expected. For the full year, they said about $10.7 billion to around $10.8 billion, and analysts wanted $10.9 billion at the midpoint. And the stock was down about 11% last night on this news, Steve. It's a pretty interesting company that's growing pretty fast internationally. Is it a buying opportunity here, Steve? Can you make the numbers work here?
So it was down 11% overnight. It's now down 18% after this open. So it's down sort of fairly heavily there. You said $2.35 to $2.40 and growing at somewhere in the region of double digits percentage. That gets you to, what does that get you to? 235 to 240 market cap is, it gets you to about 20 times earnings or so, depending on how you sort of look at that if you try and project it out a bit more. But I'm not sure. I mean, Lululemon is one of these things that seems to be kind of enduringly cool in ways that I don't fully understand. I'm not sure I... The trouble with this kind of industry, as I see it, is that switching costs are always very, very low. It's difficult to kind of attract and retain customers and keep an enduring thing going on. Trading down is always a kind of risk. And if you think you're an important brand, you're tempting to stick prices higher. And then you find that thesis getting tested a little bit. So I don't see this as a flash in the pan. I think it's probably not a brand that's going to go stale, but I'm not sure it's a brand for the now. Might that make for a buying opportunity? Maybe. I mean, I might take a closer look at this. It feels like if there's a time to be buying these things, it probably is now. So Lululemon's one for me to take a closer look at. I don't like the name very much, and it really feels like... I mean, this is a long way for me from buy what you use or buy what you own. I mean, in terms of it's clothes, and yes, I own and use clothes, but I stay so far away from Lululemon stuff because I feel like it would just look wrong on me. I don't know whether it's explicitly a women's wear brand, but everyone I think I have ever seen in any kind of Lululemon stuff, I mean, it's yoga stuff, right? Which is, I think, probably heavy female demographic, but no reason that it should be only available and accessible to women. So I'm sort of, I feel like this would be me getting out of my circle of competence here and seeing what this has that will prevent trading down. Despite apparently very impressive growth, and I heard in China you said sales up about 70-odd%. You've only got to kind of break in there a bit more and things start to look quite interesting because there is a large runway to go into on that, I think.
Yeah, I think they call it athletic wear, don't they? The full name is actually Lululemon Athletica Incorporated.
Yep.
So if you fancied a longer name, Steve, if that was Lululemon was a bit short for you. But I permanently have this thought in my head that Lululemon is just like a flash in the pan. And that people are going to stop buying it any minute now. And I also have in my head that it's only been on the market about 2 years. And I was just having a quick look then. It actually IPO'd back in 2007, I think, Steve. So it's up 27x since then. And a bit of change on top of that. So IPO'd about $14. Now, $294.22. So I suppose the people who got in really, really early are not too bothered by today's fall. But yeah, I struggle with Lululemon. I nearly bought it back at the end, sort of when the pandemic was on, and it fell to $165. And it looked really attractive to me around that kind of price. But I just figured I didn't really know enough about it to buy it. And I sort of thought there were probably better opportunities out there, which maybe they were at the time, but it's been a sort of two and a half x since then, so maybe I was wrong. But yeah, it's one of those stocks I'm really interested in. It, the sales look really good, the growth is incredible, and yet I still can't really just get my head around buying it at the moment, and I'm not entirely sure why that is. If anybody does buy Lululemon and listens, we'd be really interested to hear what your take on it is. If you can give us a quick bull case in the comments, I'd be really interested in hearing it. It's not a very well covered stock by people, so I, you know, sometimes people are dropping opinions on things and you get to pick up tidbits of news that help reinforce your thesis. Lululemon is not something that I see for a company that is a 27x that gets a lot of coverage, and that also makes it more difficult for me to follow, I guess. But it's a $47.5 billion company, Steve. It's not small. I wonder where it goes from here. I'm not entirely sure.
It's way too big to be acquired by anything, isn't it? Which is in many ways unhelpful, to be honest, with stuff starting to kind of turn down. It doesn't feel like a sort of $47 billion dollar company to me. It feels more like a sort of $8 billion company, but I think that probably goes to show how little I know about these things. The place where I think I might be tempted to look if I were looking for a bull case for Lululemon Athletica is probably in the Piper Sandler teen survey that you've covered for us a few times on this show. I have this idea that it's popular with teens, and if it's popular with teens, there's the kind of idea that if you want to know what's going to be popular in the future, look at what the teens are buying now. And I have this idea that Lululemon will show up there. Will it age with them? Which is a question we ask about a lot of things in that survey. Will they grow out of it or will it age with them? It's possible, to my mind, it ages with them and becomes, you know, the brand that they kind of reach for and go to when they reach 30s, 40s, 50s, and so on, in which case this company's going to do great, and it's got itself in there with a really important demographic, especially if it can keep doing that with the teens as well. But I think that's where I would be looking for something approaching a bull case here. We must be only about a month away from the next of those, Steve. I have this idea that that survey comes out in April.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they do 6 months now as well, don't they? They do like a small update on it as well, so maybe that's what we've got coming. But it does, that is a good point. It does regularly score pretty high in those Piper Sandler teen surveys. So perhaps that might be something that's worth worth looking into a little bit more. But yeah, interested to hear what other people have to say on this. This is one that Steve and I don't know an awful lot about. So if we have any people who follow it a bit more regularly, please pipe up.
Hey, very good. Yes, and so basically we've seen an 18% dip in a stock that we recognise but don't know that much about, and we're interested in whether it might be worth buying it. Do help us out here. But anyway, with that important kind of insight, I guess we should probably leave it there for this week. We're comfortably through the hour mark. And thank you very much for listening and watching, and do leave us a comment and a review and so on, and answer any other questions that we've asked, or ask your own ones. But for now, we've been Steve and Steve. This has been the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. We will see you next week.